Our next case for argument is 22-1018, Health Republic Insurance versus United States. Now, I'm going to try to say your name, counsel, and you'll tell me how to say it right after I mess it up. I'm going to try first. Mr. Keshavarzi?
That's correct, sir.
Are you just saying that to be nice?
No, that's
correct. Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Mo Keshavarzi for the objecting class members. Your Honors, in a certified class action, class counsel is entitled to a reasonable fee. As multiple courts of appeals have held, in determining the reasonableness of a fee award, the court should ensure that the award does not result in counsel, class counsel, being paid an hourly rate that exceeds what any lawyer could reasonably charge.
Counsel, it's my understanding that the lower tribunal has a lot of discretion in selecting attorney's fees. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, but discretion, for example, let's turn to the fee notice. It's on page 1389.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is the notice that was presented to all the class members about what attorneys would request. And it said they will request no more than 5% of any judgment or settlement. Now, while the lower tribunal has a lot of discretion on attorney's fees, do you agree that they would not have had the discretion to, for example, say, well, goodness, I don't think 5% is enough. I'm going to give them 10%.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you think that whatever discretion they have has to begin from this, which is an agreement between the attorneys and the members of the class?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think in this case, the notice is important because this, and in the context for this supplemental notice is important. So what happened, as the record indicates, Your Honor.
Yeah, we know the record, but let me finish.
Okay. That's the following. I just want to, you said, or maybe the chief said, the reason that a statement in a notice is binding is that is essentially contractual or what? What's the legal theory under which a very clear statement, and the chief just read one of them, there are others in there too, should bind the trial court in the ultimate award?
Your Honor,
under Rule 23, is it contract? Or
yes, what? So I would cite for you the City of Detroit case, which is out of the Second Circuit. And in that case, and I'm going to answer Your Honor's question directly because we're not taking the position necessarily. We did not say it's a contract, but
I'm not being skeptical. I'm looking
at
the legal theory.
But it grows out of the court's duty to act as a fiduciary for the class, and it's important in this case because class members, putative class members, relied on this notice to opt into the class, and they had other options. So that context is important. But what happened in
stop. I had more questions. So if we all agree that whether it's contractual or an implied contract, that 5% bounded, and that while the lower tribunal may have had discretion for attorney's fees, she could not have gone above the 5%, and she didn't seem to suggest otherwise. And Judge Toronto alluded to where I wanted to go next, which is this notice has other things in it. One of the other things it says is the fee may be substantially less than 5%, depending on the level of class participation. Isn't it the case that they got pretty much all the participation in this?
A significant portion, Your Honor. In fact, what Mr. Swedlow said in his declaration, that's at page 1806, paragraph 22, page 1804, paragraph 17. He said that because of this class notice and the promise that it made, the contingent of qualified health plan issuers who joined this class represents by orders of magnitude the greatest contingent of qualified health plan issuers. So it's exactly what the notice promised.
And so she didn't take it down at all for that, even though the fee, but they did say the fee may be. Right? So that's not like a guarantee, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think that's where you're going next, is there's more text in the notice that's coming up.
So let's go to the next part that says, in any event, the exact percentage will be determined by the court subject to, among other things, the amount at issue in the case and what is called a lodestar cross-check. Why isn't that a mandatory lodestar cross-check?
It is absolutely a mandatory lodestar cross-check in this case, and that's our point, Your Honor.
Like she doesn't have the discretion to go above 5%, she doesn't have the discretion to refuse to do a lodestar cross-check.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And the notice goes on to describe a lodestar cross-check as a limitation on class fees based on the number of hours actually worked. And again, I know you know the record, but this point is really important because what happened, the reason, this is a supplemental notice. The original notice didn't say anything about fees. What Quinn Emanuel learned was that some qualified health plan issuers were signing up with other law firms because they believed that Quinn was going to ask for 30% of the award. And so they wanted to correct that, and they didn't want these health plans to sign up with other lawyers. So they rushed to issue this notice to say, no, 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 don't sign up with them. We are going to only ask maximum 5%, which would be substantially reduced if the level of participation goes up. So they said, join us, because the more people that join us, the lower the fees are going to be.
So now let's talk about, if I agree with you that a mandatory lodestar cross-check had to be performed, and it wasn't in this case, the answer then, I assume, is that I vacate and remand and tell her that she needs to perform a mandatory lodestar cross-check. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And as some other courts have done, for example, the Ninth Circuit did it in the NCAA case, the court could provide guidance in terms of what the court should do when conducting a lodestar cross-check.
Well, in fact, I mean, that's one of the things I imagine that opposing counsel may stand up and say is, well, she pretty much did a lodestar cross-check when she analyzed the reasonableness of the fees, but that amounts to something close to a lodestar cross-check. Why is that not an answer to the concern I have?
Together with the sentence at the top of Appendix 25, where the Supreme Court said, even if the court applied the lodestar cross-check, a multiplier of 18 to 19 would at least not be outside the realm of reasonableness.
I have answers to all of those questions.
So let me
start by saying why it's not a lodestar cross-check. Examples of lodestar cross-checks include the In Re Enron case from Texas, for example, or the In Re Rite Aid case out of the Second District, or Judge Kaplan's decision in Kane County, Utah versus the United States. What courts do when they do a proper lodestar cross-check, it's not as if the court is awarding fees under a lodestar, so admittedly it's a lower requirement than a full-blown lodestar analysis. But still, what those cases say is that what the court must do is assess, probe, ask questions about the reasonableness of the fee. The court didn't do that here, nor could it have done that. Why? Because the sum total of the evidence of the fees expended on this case is five sentences.
I know, but you're not going to win on that. You're not going to win on their we spent 10,000 hours argument because, number one, 10,000, wow, that's a very round number. It's kind of shocking that it came out to exactly that number. But nonetheless, in the lodestar cross-check area, the level of documentation required is much less substantial. It's not like a detailed, you know, day by day, hour by hour. And we don't want that. We want attorneys to take cases on contingencies and be willing to do something less. And the reason you're not going to win on it, I don't mean you won't necessarily win with us, but all she has to say on remand is, well, 10,000 in light of my experience with this case seems reasonable.
So a couple of things right there. There's no law for this, and we looked. But when you say my experience with this case, I think it's important to note that there's a new judge that took over this case after the fee motion was filed. The judge who had this case from the beginning was a different judge than the judge who ruled on the fee motion. I think that's an important fact. With respect to the 10 hours, the reason I
thought this case was, in essence, litigated outside the claims court.
Yes, but Judge Moore.
Anyway, so it's not like there was a lot to observe. There was a motion to dismiss. Ruled on, and then basically all of the interesting legal work got done in this court and then the Supreme Court in other cases.
That's correct. I was just
to observe.
My apologies, Ron. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just responding to Judge Moore's comment about, in my experience with this case, 10,000 hours is enough. But let me tell you why, and on this point, and I'm going to go to the multiplier in a minute. But 10,000 hours, Your Honor, the reason I think there should have been more evidence here, okay, of the fees is this. This case, the class certification was conceded in this case. The government didn't fight it. There was no discovery, and the case was stayed, as Your Honor noted, shortly after it was filed. There was amicus work that was done after the case was stayed. But according to Mr. Swedlow's declaration and according to the brief they filed with the Supreme Court, which are all in the record, That the expense for that was paid by somebody else, not by the class. That's not part of the lodestar. So it is hard to understand how, and 10,000 hours is five lawyers working full-time for an entire year. It's hard to understand, given the fact that the case was stayed shortly after it was filed, how 10,000 hours could have been racked up on this case. That's why I think in this case, one sentence that says...
It might have had something to do with the fact that there were a bunch of other cases with other lawyers and conversations had to just go on endlessly about between the lawyers.
It's possible, Your Honor, but we don't know because all we have is Mr. Swedlow's statement that on these cases we spent 10,000 hours. And while it is true that in some cases where lesser fees at stake, where the attorney is not asking to be paid $18,000 an hour, it might be okay to take a sentence that says I spent 2,000 hours. In a case like this, I think that...
Okay, we understand this point. Why don't you... Your better argument's the multiplier, so okay. Get to it. So so she didn't... She only cited three cases, two of which didn't appeal the high multi... She cited three cases with high multipliers. Am I right in understanding that your multiplier here is in excess of 18?
Yes.
Even if we accept 10,000 hours.
If it's at least 18.
Yeah.
Let me start by this. There's been a lot of research done on this case. We've done a lot of work. They've done a lot of work. The Supreme Court has been talking about fee applications since the 1880s. As far as we can tell, no case they cited, not a single Court of Appeals decision, not a single Court of Appeals in the history of the United States has ever awarded a multiple this high. Ever. And the three cases the judge cited, one is an unpublished decision from...
Well, two of them, they didn't raise an objection.
Right, and what
and the third didn't do a lodestar analysis.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what the court said is, I found these cases. I mean, the task, as the Third Circuit said in Ray Prudential case, the court's task in evaluating a multiplier is to look at cases, try to find similar cases, and explain why the multiplier is justified. The task should not be, as this court did, to say, well, some court somewhere has awarded a multiplier of 18.
And so we shouldn't accept as an adequate or equivalent to a lodestar multiplier what she did, because the only thing that she cited when she said it's reasonable are three district court cases, two of which didn't appeal the multiplier, one of which didn't do a lodestar analysis at all. And what ought I make of this Newberg treatise, which seems to suggest that in contingency fee cases, the normal multiplier is in the range of 1 to 2 with a presumptive ceiling at 4?
Your Honor, that's Newberg. You could also go to their own expert, Mr. Fitzpatrick. If you look at the appendix at page 1978, in our footnote, we talk about, or in the text and the footnote, we talk about Mr. Fitzpatrick, their own expert, whose declaration they submitted to the claims court, said that the average multiplier, most multipliers are in the low ones, and the average multiplier is below 2.
Well, when you say most multiples are in the low ones, was he giving testimony, and help me because I don't recall the record, but specifically on a contingent fee case? Because that makes a difference, right? I mean, that's a big difference. And I don't know that he was limiting his analysis to contingency fee cases.
I don't believe he was, Your Honor.
And that would make a really big difference.
It would make a difference.
The Newberg treatise was actually discussing contingency cases.
Yes, Your Honor. And Your Honor, if you... even the multipliers the judge cited, one of them was in the fives. It wasn't, 18. And most of the cases, the Third Circuit has discussed this issue. The Third Circuit's convened a task force on this issue. They have noted that, a multiplier of high single digits is reserved for extremely rare cases. And so most multipliers fall in the 1 to 2 range. And to go to 18 is truly, truly unprecedented, Your Honors.
Okay, I'd like to... save some time for rebuttal.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to understand how this lodestar cross-check actually works. If you do a lodestar cross-check and say, well, based on norms across a lot of different cases, we see that a multiplier of more than 4 or 5 is really, really rare. And so therefore, even though we're adopting a percentage of the fund methodology, we're cutting it off at a lodestar multiplier of 4. I'm just wondering, do you see that kind of analysis as essentially converting a percentage of the fund approach into a de facto lodestar methodology?
Any
amount that you would reach and calculate through a percentage of the fund approach is ultimately going to be cut off, curtailed, amended by a lodestar approach that
has a ceiling of a multiplier of 4?
Your Honor, I would say no, and the answer is that the Ninth Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Second Circuit have all adopted similar approaches in advising their district courts about the upper limits of what a reasonable multiplier is. And they advise their district courts that while you have discretion, that there are upper limits and these are the ranges that you should look to and you should care to explain what analogizes a case to this case where you think a multiplier is justified. So, and those high multipliers are reserved for cases where counsel tries a case all the way to trial, takes 5 or 6 years, like the Enron case where the multiplier was less than 7, even though they had litigated for 6 years, trial, many years of document review. So
let me get this straight. So if you work 10,000 hours, you should get a low multiplier, but if you work 100,000 hours, you should get a bigger, fatter multiplier?
No, Your Honor, it's not that if you work more hours, you get a bigger multiplier. It goes to the complexity of the case and what it took. So there are a lot of factors that go into it. I don't believe that hours is just one factor. But
is your argument, can I understand your argument to be that in a contingency fee case, counsel's taking a much bigger risk if they're putting 100,000 hours in than they are if they're putting 10,000?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
That should be factored in?
That's absolutely correct. And Your Honor's concern is not we have not seen that with respect to district court decisions that have come out of Ninth Circuit, Third Circuit, or Second Circuit guidance, Your Honor.
If the class notice had just said a hard 5%, period, would we be here still?
Depends what else it said, Your Honor, because if it said...
If it just said 5%.
Without saying that it would be subject to a cross-check. I think the district court in that instance would still... it would be good practice for the district court to act as a fiduciary for the class, which is an obligation it has. And
Even though there was an ex-ante bargained agreement between...
There are no circumstances. No agreement by counsel can lead to the district court abdicating its responsibility, fiduciary responsibility to the class. So what the cases say that is that in the Third Circuit and in Ray Prudential, for example, in the fee context, the attorney and the client are adverse almost. So the court has to step in to protect the client. And so I'm giving the answer to your question.
Insurance companies can't protect themselves?
See, Your Honor, the concern, your statement wasn't specific to insurance companies, and I think it's dangerous to give guidance to a court that says if there's an agreement, because most class actions are consumers, and I think the court needs to step in and act as a fiduciary. And I don't think
And it might be different depending on whether the notice said we will... ask for 5%, and on the other hand, saying we will ask for up to 5%, full stop, but the court will determine the proper amount.
I think that would make a difference, but there are cases, Judge Chen, where parties have agreed to a rate, and the court still comes in and says, I'm going to evaluate to see whether it's reasonable. The bankruptcy court case out of Maryland that the claims court actually cited involved an agreement for 30%, but the court came in to see whether it was unethical.
Okay, if you want any rebuttal,
yes, I'm sorry. Is that okay, Judge Chen?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it Mr. Schaffer?
Schaefer.
I got the harder one.
Thank you, Chief Judge Moore. May it please the court. I'm going to start right with the notice, Your Honors. I know those were the first questions posed, but let me answer your question, Judge Toronto. It's the back of the opening brief that the notice is raised. There's no legal authority that is cited for a contractual theory or a constitutional theory or even a Rule 23 theory for why there was some violation here. The best sense that I can make of it, because I don't think any of us thinks a notice is a contract, is that there could be a due process violation if the class was informed of one thing,
Maybe one way of saying is that if after the notice is given and people rely on it by opting in, maybe even we can say it can be presumed irrebuttably that they relied on everything in it, that the notice, if not honored later, would not turn out in retrospect to have been a fair notice.
2 points, Judge Toronto. Number one, I think you'd be limited to the express terms of the notice and what would be reasonably understood from those plain terms. And number two, to the extent you go beyond that, here the testimony is unrefuted in declarations that the only discussions around the 5% was counsel would be asking for 5%. That's in the Swedlow declarations. It's uncontradicted.
Isn't it the phrase up to 5%?
The parole evidence, if you will, Judge Toronto, the discussions around that with these highly sophisticated insurers were, we'll be seeking 5%, but if a settlement materializes.
And you had discussions with all members of the class.
It's certainly the United and Kaiser who are the primary constituency of the objectors, but they don't deny, Judge Toronto, no one is here saying they were told in the circumstances that materialized where there was no settlement, it was fully and finally decided all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the participation, Chief Judge Moore, was one-third. One-third. When the United States had been discussing this with Mr. Swedlow, and this is in his declaration at Appendix 2215, you can also find it at 1801 and 02 in the record, the discussions were the United States wanted full participation, everyone in the class, and if that happened and they had settled, then, in that circumstance, the fee would have been, I think, reasonably below 5%. Nothing like that happened.
Okay, but what about the fact that the notice said there would be a lodestar crosscheck?
I want to get to that right now, Chief Judge Moore, but one last point about the notice, if I may, which is that it is conceded by the objectors in the reply brief at 29 that 5% could have followed if there had been lower class participation. Their characterization is that it was somehow a high rate of class participation. That's just their characterization.
Okay, one-third. Can you answer my question?
Yes. Sorry, Chief Judge Moore. There was a lodestar crosscheck. You can find it at Appendix 2425. If the Court of Federal Claims...
Are you talking about where she said it would have been reasonable?
Where she addressed the argument in the alternative. Yeah. And she did that after analyzing...
Where did she address the argument in the alternative?
It's the even if,
Your Honors. I don't think...
So let me just get something that I guess has been on my mind since I read that sentence. This says, even if I did a lodestar cross-check, and let's even assume that, you know, it was sort of an adequate one, what she said, what the claims court says is that would not be outside the realm of reasonableness. And I guess the thought that occurred to me was this, that that's just the wrong question. In attorney's fees cases, when an adjudicator is to set the fee, the adjudicator doesn't say, here is the range of what would be reasonable. Of course, there's arbitrariness and imprecision, so there's going to be a range. I can and should award or even start with the top end or any request below the top end, I grant that. And that's what outside the range of reasonableness sounds like. It seems to me that's confusing the appellate review of the discretion of an adjudicator, which says you've got a range of reasonableness. But the adjudicator's job is to decide what the award should be, taking account of all of the relevant policies of attorney's fees. So this seems to me not to be asking the right question. Address that.
Judge Toronto, forgive me for disagreeing, but I invoke Judge Chen's question. It is settled law of this circuit that you can use the percentage of the fund approach, where you essentially disregard the lodestar. What we're talking about is a complement to that is the lodestar cross-check. Not the touchstone, not the determinant of the fee, it's just a double check to make sure it's within the realm of reasonableness. And don't take my word for that. If you read the reply brief, pages 14 and 15, you will see the objectors acknowledging, and I think my friend did just now at the podium. But the lodestar cross-check is not how you're arriving at the fee, it's just a double check to make sure that you haven't gone outside the bounds of reasonableness. And that is, once you understand it to be a lodestar cross-check, it is a complement. It's not a substitute for the district court's exercise, the court of claims exercise of discretion
but,
in this
but
respect.
Counsel, there's factors that are typically employed in a lodestar cross-check, and I don't see her having analyzed those factors here. For example, what are typical multipliers in other similarly situated cases? The fact that she was able to identify three district court cases, two of which did not involve a challenge to the multiplier, and the third, which didn't actually do a lodestar cross-check, doesn't seem to me that she accurately or adequately addressed what are typical multipliers in other cases.
Forgive me for disagreeing again. Can I take the three cases, Chief Judge Moore? The first one that I would direct your honors to is America's Mining, decided by the Delaware Supreme Court. And I acknowledge The court there did not use the word lodestar crosscheck, but what the court did do is specifically say, this is at 51 F3rd, 1257 and 58, after saying that essentially it was a 66 times multiple.
There are three cases. Two of them didn't object. One of them, she acknowledges, didn't do a lodestar crosscheck. You're going to try and tell me now it did, but it's kind of irrelevant because she says in her opinion no crosscheck was conducted. So I don't see how you could possibly prevail on this point. The treatises, all of the evidence of record suggests that the typical multiplier is in the 1 to 2 range with a presumptive cap at 4, and that's for contingency fee cases, which is what this is. I don't see that she acknowledged that, analyzed that. I certainly see that they argued it, but I don't see her having performed that analysis and acknowledging it. And this seems to be one of the most critical factors the lodestar crosscheck ought to look at, which is the range of usual normal multipliers in cases like this.
Yeah. Chief Judge Moore, when I've seen that formulation that you look at comparable cases, it's as to the fee percentage. And it is undisputed here that the fee percentage, 5%, is on the low side.
The treatise says otherwise.
The Newberg treatise that you're referring to, Your Honor, I read it to be descriptive and acknowledging that there is discretion that is exercised in this respect. You asked about the Fitzpatrick Declaration. If you read the supplemental declaration, it specifically points out that because a lot of courts don't report the lodestar crosscheck, doesn't come through the record.
It's talking about lodestar multipliers. That's part of the lodestar crosscheck, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. That's the defining.
Now it says, in contingency fee cases, empirical evidence of multipliers across many cases demonstrates most multipliers are in the relatively modest 1 to 2 range. This fact counsels in favor of a presumptive ceiling of 4 or slightly above twice the mean. So what is your response to that? That is in the analysis of a lodestar crosscheck multiplier. That seems like pretty strong evidence.
My friend points to the Enron case. And if you read the Enron case, where the multiple was, I think, at 5-something, that was a case where the recovery for the class was 20% of what is claimed. And the court there notes that usually in class actions, we're talking about recovering 3-6%. Or Professor Fitzpatrick says sometimes it could be as high as 20%. Here we're looking at a class action that recovered 100% against the United States government in a case where, Chief Judge Moore, the risks were greater than in the usual class action, because even though in the Enron case and many other class actions...
Yes, but the level of risk is a separate factor than multipliers. What I'm saying, I'm not saying you lose. I'm saying we need to vacate and remand because she didn't do what she was required to do, what you all put the world on notice would happen before any attorney fee judgment was determined. You put the world on notice. There would be a lodestar crosscheck. She didn't do it.
Respectfully, I'm trying to convince Your Honors that that's not the correct disposition, and if you were to do that, to not be as prescriptive as the other side suggests, the case that was cited in that notice was Geneva Rock. In the Geneva Rock case, the Court of Federal Claims relied solely upon an attorney's attestation. There was not even specification as to what the hourly rate was. It was just statutory fees. It used that for the lodestar crosscheck, arrived at a ratio that was above 5. And there, Chief Judge Moore, the percentage, the fee percentage, was 35%. That's what class counsel was recovering, 35%. If we had sought 35%, then the lodestar crosscheck number would have gone above 100, above where it had been in the America's Mining case that the Delaware Supreme Court decided after the trial court there, the Court of Chancery, had brought the requested fee down from 22.5% to 15%. That's what got the fee to the level where the lodestar crosscheck there would have been 66. And the Delaware Supreme Court explained why that was commendable. The court had looked at what the hourly rate would be based upon this analysis, had clipped the fee to bring it down to 15%, resulting in 66-1. That was another case where it was not 100% recovery. This is on the outer high end of class action recoveries. It is against the United States government in a case where the class and counsel would have been completely zeroed out, absent the intervention of the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's every reason, I respectfully submit, why this multiple would be on the high end. You have the Delaware Supreme Court's considered judgment on this.
I'm trying to sit here and figure out to myself why you're being so aggressive, pointing your finger at us and sort of yelling at the court. And I realize it's your money. So please continue.
I don't mean to point my finger or to be aggressive. I just mean, Chief Judge Moore, respectfully to push back on the suggested disposition.
so far, just so you know, your approach has not been respectful.
Please accept my apologies to Your Honor.
I realize it's your money. Hey, if I had $187 million on the line, I'd probably lose my cool a little too, so go for it.
Chief Judge Moore, it's not about that, and I want to point out that I personally did not participate in the action in question. So it's not my good work. But
when
someone,
you say you didn't participate in the action in question, are you a partner at Quinn Emanuel?
I am.
Do
in
you
that sense.
Wait. Does your profit and your paycheck reflect whether or not Quinn Emanuel gets this $187 million?
Your Honor, I'd have to ask the powers that be what the...
Does your share of the partnership guarantee you a percentage of profit?
Now we're getting to things that I'd put on the public record. It's really subject to what the powers that be decide about my entitlement in particular
year. It's not your money.
But,
it is your money.
But if I may simply say this, Chief Judge Moore, as someone who has, even before I was at Quinn Emanuel, spent much of my career litigating against the United States government, as Professor Fitzpatrick attests, and as Your Honors know, this is not a defendant who's likely to settle. This is not a defendant who fears being subjected to a $12 billion recovery. This is a defendant that will litigate all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the risk in this class action, different from many where class counsel may invest a lot of time and money, there's going to be some recovery. It's just a question of what's the settlement.
Do you agree that, as a general matter, the lodestar multiplier tends to be between the range of 1 to 4?
I think that that is true in terms of the reporting decisions, Judge Chen, with the high side being what we've seen in the America's Mining decision, the only decision you have from a higher court, the Stop and Shop decision, which specifically was lowering the fee to get
down. These are the cases the claims court cited.
Correct.
Those three.
We can read
those and decide for ourselves what the value is of those.
Yes, but Judge Chen, I think that it is underreported the amount of lodestar cross-checks that are on the high side simply because courts don't tend to report those numbers if they look to be high, and neither does class counsel do that.
What about In Re Sendent, the Third Circuit opinion?
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. What's wrong with the approach the Third Circuit took in Re Sendent, which seems to work against you here?
Well, in Re Sendent, I don't think that the district court there had analyzed the prescribed factors, and it had not gone through the analysis that this court did over the course of 28 pages to say what were the comparable rates, what was the market rate for this sort of a representation. So in the absence of that, the court was simply looking at the lodestar crosscheck and saying that it had not been performed, and essentially...
Well, they concluded that a multiplier of 7 or 10 is just extremely high compared to the norms. And then said, therefore, there's an abuse of discretion that happened here, and then remanded it back, but then gave a very strong signal that it thought a multiplier of 3 would be appropriate. Am I recalling the case correctly?
You are, Judge Chen. And I'm just saying that that was an instruction for remand to a court that had not gone through the prescribed analysis, had not explained why you would go above the traditional lodestar, what might be the average of that. Here you have a case where the average rate is below that of the usual class action. It's the lowest market rate that was available to any of the plaintiffs that recovered in this case by a considerable amount. The other contingency fees were 25% that had been agreed to by each of the lead plaintiffs, had been 15%, was the lowest reported number for anyone else. Here, the class members are getting one-third of that 15% number. 5% is the amount they paid to counsel for an off-the-charts, unprecedented recovery, dollar for dollar against the United States. That is a case where you would expect the lodestar crosscheck to be on the high side, and you do respectfully have precedents that have signed off on lodestar crosschecks that were at or above this number. I just don't think that there's a problem in terms of the notice, and in terms of the application of the factors, it is thoroughly explained. It is well substantiated, and my friends for the other side really don't dispute the key factual premises of what the Court of Federal Claims decided. You can find it Appendix 18, that this was the best rate that was available in the market. And really, that should be very telling to Your Honors, because we're talking about highly sophisticated...
Your time is up. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Chief Judge Moore, and I apologize if my tone or my gesticulation was in any way offensive to the Court.
Okay, counsel, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just briefly, I want to start first with the last thing counsel said, that this was the best rate that was available in the market. Paragraph 14 of Mr. Swedlow's declaration makes it clear that putative class members had two options. They could have signed with counsel on a contingency basis, or they were signing hourly agreements. So it's not true that this was the best rate available in the market. And the statement about the best rate available in the market is what I said earlier, that some putative class members were signing with other firms at 15% because they believed Quinn was going to ask for 30%. So they thought their choice was 15 and 30. They did not know that Quinn was going to say up to 5. So that's one issue with respect to that was the best deal that was available on the market. Counsel talks about Mr. Swedlow's side conversations with class members saying, even though this is what we said in the notice, you should expect something else. We addressed this issue in pages 1985 and 1986 of the appendix in our briefs. And there's cases we've cited for the proposition that the court cannot and should not rely on statements that counsel makes that contradict the class notice. That's just bad law in our view and based on the cases that we've cited. And the final point I want to make, Judge Toronto, I was about to give you the citation and we got whisked away on a discussion earlier, and that was you had talked to me about the notice and what it means and the import of it. The case I was citing to Your Honor was a City of Detroit case out of the Second Circuit, and one point of the City of Detroit case, there's a lot of language in there, but there's one particular point that I think is
Grinnell.
Yes, Grinnell Corporation.
Partly overruled later by the Second Circuit.
Yes, yes. One reason the Second Circuit sent the case back to the district court with respect to the fee issue was that the class notice had promised an evidentiary hearing at which the fees would be determined. The district court had decided on its own that it was not going to hold an evidentiary hearing, and the Second Circuit said the failure to do that which you promised to the class is improper abuse of discretion and send it back. Your Honors, unless you have any questions for me, I thank you for your time.
Thank you.